Hello, friends. We're going back to the Bronze Age for a couple of episodes. Next week will be an interview with a specialist on the Bronze Age. However, today is a gift to one of my patrons, Eli. Eli joined the community last month, and I sent him a message to thank him and asked him what he'd like to see. He mentioned how much he enjoyed walking around the Avebury landscape, past sites like Silbury Hill, West Kennet Long Barrow, and the Sanctuary. This is a walk I've done many times, and he sparked the idea for an episode that might be a relatively research-light, entertaining episode. In other words, an episode ideally suited for an in-between special. Thanks for the support and the inspiration, Eli. I must also give a shout out to my other new patron, Amanda. New patrons are the singly most inspiring thing I've ever come across, so thank you to Amanda and all those who've chosen to support me. Finally, before we dig into the show, I wanted to let you know that I recently featured on a podcast called A Moment of Your Time. A Moment of Your Time is a creative community podcast where every episode is created by someone wanting to share an idea close to them and beneficial to the world. I created a short-on version, the cliff notes, if you will, of our end-of-season episode, although I do take a slightly more political stance considering what's been going on recently. The link is, as always, in the show notes if you'd like to check that episode out. Now, let's get back to archaeology. Today, we're going to Avebury. Avebury is in Wiltshire, the Neolithic heart of southern England. Within this enormous henge is Britain's largest stone circle, which is so large it has multiple smaller stone circles within the large circle itself. And within the henge is a complete medieval village. That's not all. Avebury sits at the heart of a landscape packed with prehistoric monuments. In fact, we've already had a reason to visit the Avebury landscape. But just before that, let me introduce you to Avebury's geography. The henge itself sits at the lowest point in a bowl-like landscape near a river. The henge is surrounded by hills, all of which are dotted with prehistoric monuments. To the south, sitting just above Avebury, overlooking it and Silbury Hill, is West Kennet Long Barrow. West Kennet is one of two long barrows we discussed way back in the early days of Season 1. During the time West Kennet was built 5,500 years ago, another key feature of the landscape was developed, but this time to the north of Avebury. This feature is called Windmill Hill. Windmill Hill is a causewayed enclosure, similar to that of Hambledon Hill, a site we mentioned in passing during the same episode in which we discussed West Kennet Long Barrow. Causewayed enclosures are made up of concentric rings of banks, but unlike, say, an Iron Age hill fort, these banks are quite low and studded with gaps. Causewayed enclosures also contain very few finds. The traditional explanation is that the banks are designed to make the sites highly visible and that they acted as gathering places. Still, for what reason, we don't know. The reason causewayed enclosures, henges and barrows were so visible is that these are chalkland landscapes we're talking about. And so these features, when they were first built, would have been bright white, like the horse carved into the bank at Uffington. The actual henge of Avebury was built a few hundred years after West Kennet and Windmill Hill, probably long after they stopped being active monuments, but they would have still been very visible in the landscape. Between 5,000 and 4,000 years ago, during the late Neolithic and early Bronze Age periods, the henge was built, as were the multiple stone circles within the henge. Silbury Hill was also built at this time, and it is an odd monument. It is a large, man-made mound with a flattened top, sitting low in the landscape between Avebury and West Kennet Long Barrow. Despite multiple excavations, all we've found inside the mound are the shovels and picks used to build the thing. Running past Avebury and Silbury Hill is the River Kennet. It's a small river now, but judging by the size of the valley, the river must have once been much more substantial. There were other monuments built during this time. The sanctuary was built on a hill southeast of Avebury and connected to the henge by a series of paired stones flanking an avenue. Along that route were smaller monuments like Faulkner Circle, a small circle of stones. Finally, completing this brief overview of the Avebury landscape, around 4,000 to 3,700 years ago, multiple round barrows were built all around the landscape. Almost always, these barrows were constructed on the hills looking into the henge or towards Silbury Hill. If you've been listening carefully, you might have noticed that this landscape has quite a few similarities to the Stonehenge landscape. You're not wrong, and in fact, this episode can be seen as an expanded sequel to the Stonehenge episode. There will be a similar narrative. Some themes will repeat, except this time we're going to explore another theory that these processions were linked to rites of passage. We're also going to use a specific set of theoretical approaches to imagining the Avebury landscape. This whole episode is based on two articles. The first is by Aaron Watson, who has applied ideas of aesthetics to the Avebury landscape. The second was written by Joanna Brook, who explored how Neolithic monuments affected how people thought of themselves. This episode also draws explicitly on the theory of phenomenology, developed for archaeology by people like Julian Thomas and Christopher Tilley. Phenomenology is a philosophical study of experience. In archaeology, phenomenology argues that you can seek to experience archaeological material at an emotional and spiritual level. That experience of the object may reveal uses or effects of that material on the people who created that archaeological material. Archaeological phenomenology can get a bit woolly when talking about individual features or objects. Still, it can be potent when seeking to understand how different sites interacted with each other within a landscape. Phenomenology can be very powerful. The way we think is often directly impacted by the environment in which we're doing the thinking. For example, the worlds we imagine when reading about the past in a modern, sterile university library are very different from the ways we imagine the past when standing in a medieval cathedral. When reading in the library, one becomes more concerned with social structures or focus on the elites. When you're engaging directly with the archaeological material, the life of people in the past looms far larger in the imagination than their social structures or means of production. Being amongst ancient material, whether standing in buildings or holding artifacts, provides a visceral, innate feeling about what the past might have been like. Doubly so when you understand how material culture would have looked or been used in the past. It is good to deeply study ancient landscapes and then visit and walk those landscapes. This is especially so at places like Avebury, where there has been little fundamental change to the area since the main features were constructed. Thus, the modern landscape is a cleaner canvas on which to paint our imaginings of the past. However, like most theories, phenomenology is far from flawless, especially when it is applied to archaeological contexts. First of all, phenomenology in archaeology isn't really phenomenology. I don't want to get into the details here, but suffice it to say that phenomenology is an idea pioneered by Heidegger, who was a complicated man. He was a fascist in 1930s Germany, but it is for another episode to debate Heidegger the man. Heidegger the philosopher was nothing less than a genius, though a big brain has no correlation with good morals, quite the opposite sometimes. Heidegger saw humans as historically constructed. Heidegger wanted people to embrace the messiness of their existence and to steer into that when interpreting the world. Archaeological applications of phenomenology instead seek to divest themselves of modern contexts and observe landscapes purely, which some, me included, would argue is impossible. Archaeology isn't a subject about recreating the past. It's a subject which uses the past to try and understand what it means to be human. The context every person carries with them is essential in helping them understand how and why they think about the past and what that might mean for shared human experience. Further down into the rabbit hole of subjectivity, phenomenological archaeology often consciously rejects objectivity and science. This makes its conclusions challenging to test in any way that leads to consensus. Instead, it merely relies on opinions which can often make its findings almost useless. This is important. In archaeology, postmodern theories are compelling, but they need to build upon the scientific archaeology of data and statistics, so that even if we're going to debate interpretations, we are at least agreed on the data. There are other criticisms, but they don't impact what we're trying to achieve today. And anyway, despite these criticisms, I think phenomenology has a place, especially in trying to create visceral narratives which help explain what the past might have been like. Archaeological phenomenology isn't a great tool for creating historical knowledge. Instead, it is a tool for summarizing archaeological narratives that are easy to grasp. Today, we're taking a phenomenological walk through the landscape of Avebury. However, as you might have guessed by this long preamble, I need to be transparent with you here. This is a work of imagination. It is fiction. Many of you have told me how much you enjoy my attempts to bring the past to life. So I wanted to make one entire episode out of one single narrative. However, for reasons that I will announce in the next episode, I've had to keep the reading to a minimum for this episode. And that's kind of okay here. After all, this is primarily a work of imagination and fiction based upon academic research. Furthermore, I know Avebury's landscape well. I've visited multiple times and written numerous papers about the site. Yet it would be wrong to suggest this is anything more than a musing on one possible experience of the Avebury landscape at one particular time. If you'd like to dive deeper into phenomenology or the Avebury landscape, then become a patron for $2.50 a month. The script for this and every other episode, including all of my sources, will be available immediately on Patreon. The link is in the show notes. But that's enough promo for now. Get yourself comfortable. Pour yourself something of what you fancy. We're going back 4,500 years, and we're going to find ourselves on the grassy chalklands of southwest England. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and welcome to Old Bones. Breathe in. The world is black, but smells heavy like damp grass and sweet like honeysuckle, buttercup, and meadowsweet. The blindfold is rough, unhemmed, and made of wool. You run your finger beneath it to scratch where it rests on your cheek. You breathe out. You feel a pull on your neck, pulling you further up the steep bank on which you stand. The sun is hot on the back of your neck and you can feel sweat beginning to bead on your top lip. Up another step you pulled. Others are also being dragged forwards. You can hear their heavy treads on the dirt path as they're pulled along with you. Further up the hill, you're dragged and left again and again. In silence, save for heavy steps, laboured breaths and rustles in the distance of a gentle breeze in old oak trees. You flex your hands in and out to stem the frustration at the slow pace and discomfort. Again you're dragged and again you're left, up, up and up the hill. And then, the slope flattens beneath your feet. The air feels a little cooler, the breeze a bit more constant. You're pushed in the back and tugged a little further, and then a set of rough knuckles from a sweaty body behind you rip the blindfold from your eyes. You're on top of the world. You've been taken to the top of a ridgeway, where you stand outside a timber circle. Around you are 8 other young people dressed in simple shifts that are warm enough but do little to keep out the wind. Your feet are bare and dusty. Behind each of you stands a burly man. They also wear pale shifts, however, your clothes are slightly misfitted, drowning your figures. The shifts of the burly men are clinched in tight by a belt around the waist. Their long hair is held together in braids with tresses made of gold. Their thick wrists are clasped with bracelets of gold. On their feet are shoes of dark leather, and in their hands, small but deadly and nimble-looking axes of bronze. The 10th, burly man, steps into the centre, holding, instead of an axe, a great staff with leaves wrapped around the top. The 10th man looks at each of you, and when his eyes fall on you, you do your best to keep his gaze, but the intensity of his stare forces you to bow your head. The 10th man speaks. All of you here are on the edge of adulthood. Each one of you has seen 12 winters. It is time you took your first steps into adulthood, become true members of the community. Follow me. The man begins to walk around the timber circle. The burly man behind you pushes you in the back, and you stumble forwards in the same direction. A quarter way around the timber circle, you are all stopped. You're looking out across a vast valley. A small river winds its way gently through the bottom of the valley, and here and there, copses of trees stand, rustling and slightly swaying in the gentle breeze. Across, on the other side of the valley, glinting in the sunlight of a midsummer mid-afternoon, are a mass of white banks. In the centre is an open space, undisturbed and darkly green. That is what the tenth man points towards. See there, the gathering place of the ancestors. They reside there still, and so we give them space. It is those who built the site which also made this land, those who turned it from a dark wilderness into light and fertile earth. We live in the world they have made. We must maintain and improve what is begun, to turn the land from chaos into calm. See the work we do. The man points to a vast hill. It is unlike any hill you've ever seen. It's perfectly shaped and juts up from the valley floor like a woman's breast. Near the top of the mound is an indent. Its surface is entirely white, and it curves around the hill like the crescent of the moon. See what we have built, a watching place. I have been to the top of the hill, and I have seen the world from its white platform. The ancestors feel close there, and when we light the sweet-scented flames as we shall tonight, it's though we are calling them across the hills and across time, across space. The man pauses, seemingly contemplative. And he points to the space left of the perfect mound. There, a stream of people is moving. And see, still further, the rest of the community, those full grown, and they move a different path to you, an easier path. Your journey today will be watched by death, while their route is guarded by life. All being well, sometime soon, you will join them. Follow me. You move further around the timber circle until the cluster of white mounds is to your right and only visible in your peripheral vision. You are looking across another valley, this one less broad but steeper. Atop the bank ahead of you are two huge white mounds. They're as white as the other place, but whereas that place was a jumble, indistinct save for the central circle, these tombs were sharp-edged and distinct, dominating the horizon. Whereas that place was a jumble, indistinct save for the central circle, these mounds are sharp-edged and distinct, dominating the horizon. From gathering to death, and then to a new gathering place, that is the journey we each go on, and it has been that way forever, speaks the tenth man. Behold the death homes of our ancestors. There they live in comfort forever, with endless food and drink. That is the fate of all those who labour well in service of the community, residing with the family forever, with forever fertile crops beneath a warm sun that is never too hot, and always gentle rain. You gaze out at the sights. You've heard of them before. No one knows anymore when they were built. You've heard that within those mounds are the mortal remains of the first people to tame the land. You can't help but stare. It feels like the tombs look back at you, calling you towards them, asking you for food, for drink, and for companionship. The burly man behind you slaps an arm on your shoulder. You jolt, look at the mounds one last time, and shiver. Then you are half led, half pushed towards the entrance of the timber circle. The timbers are each as thick as a man's chest, and all are as tall as two people, one stood on the other's shoulders. Between each pillar stretches a thick piece of wood from which dangles mistletoe and other plants. It feels like you're being pulled into a dense copse of trees. Inside, despite the spaces between each pillar, it's impossible to see out. Each row of timbers is offset, surrounding you with a bedazzling array. The trunks create a sparse but impenetrable wall. It's quiet inside. Not deathly quiet, but muted. You can still hear the birds chirping beyond the timbers, but they're softer and masked slightly by the gentle breeze rustling the leaves hanging from the lintels between each post. You focus your attention on the tenth man, the leader who is standing waiting for you. At one side of him is a basket filled with small, dark brown loaves of bread. To his other side is a large leather sack suspended from a tripod. You try and peer in from where you're standing, in a semicircle, 5 strides from the leader. There is a hint of still dark liquid inside. It's been hours since you last ate or drank anything. Today's journey will not be easy, young ones. Your youth today will die. But you will remain. Changed, but ready to become fully part of our people. You will face horrors and torments. The world will become dark, but it is in the darkness that you will learn that death and life are interconnected. All living things die, but it's from their end that new life is given space to appear. Are you ready? The man gazes at every one of you. When his eyes reach yours, you don't bow your head in fear. Instead, you look him in the eyes. Nod. Good, the man says, and then nods to the burly men. One by one, your group is led to the tenth man. He gives each of you some bread, and then takes a beaker decorated richly with scratches, zigzags, and swirls, and plunges it deep into the leather bag of liquid. He gives a cup, shining now with the liquid, to each of you. The beaker is sticky in your hand, and the liquid smells sharp, but malty, sweet, and dangerous. The bread is firm but light in your hand. It smells fresh and delicious, filling your mouth with saliva and making your belly writhe with hunger. When one of us dies, they are laid with drink and with food. This then is the funeral feast of your youth. Drink deep and eat well. Consume everything you are given. It would all be necessary at some point. You bite into the bread and it is delicious, luxurious, sweet and soft. The outside crunchy and a little smoky from the hint of char. But the food is unadorned and soon your mouth is dry. So you take a deep draught from the drink, swallowing quickly to take down the bread. It's like drinking flames. It lights up your body. Your mouth is filled with a sickly sweet taste that does little to mask the acrid sensation. You cough. Don't lose a drop, says the burly man behind you. Trust me, the drink is good. You nod, eat more bread and pour more drink down your throat. It's better this time and it gets better every time. Once the food and drink are gone, you look up and the world seems to wobble a little bit. Everything is a little less focused and yet far more immediate. The tenth man speaks once again. We are ready. Brace yourselves, young one. This journey is not a simple one. He walks out of the circle. The burly man gives you a push, a little gentler than the last, and you move forward. You are aware of each step, and you find yourself focusing hard to make sure you do not stumble. There's a sloshing in your belly, and the lightness in your soul. Out of the circle you move. Ahead of you are 2 large, unshaped grey stones. They flank a pathway of beaten earth. That pathway heads seemingly straight towards the gathering space. You look up again towards the gathering place and then stare at the perfect mound with a slither of white like the crescent moon. The line of people keeps moving towards something you cannot see. You turn your head back for one last look at the timber circle and the stark silhouettes of the ancestors' tomb. And then the path leads downwards. Down, down you go. The air gets colder and the birdsong changes from happy chirping to ominous caws. More trees appear, and as they move in the breeze, they blur in your vision, making them seem unworldly. Your feet feel the ground turn softer. You tread and squelch your way deeper into the valley. The sun becomes obscured, and the air cools. You shiver. You look up, hoping to see the gathering place or the perfect mound, but they're obscured now by trees and a low ridge in the near distance. At the base of the hill, to one side of the avenue, you see torches flickering madly and figures moving around a small circle of short stones. As you move further down, they disappear entirely. Instead, you are left with nothing but a sense of isolation. The funny feeling in your head turns your companions into blurs. Their footsteps get quieter on the softer ground. The burly man doesn't feel quite so close to you as before, and the giant pairs of stones that repeatedly flank the avenue loom over you as you pass. The torches into the stone circle, which was hiding at the base of the ridge, come closer and closer. The individual fires lighting up the ring become easier to separate. The figures moving around the stones are more distinct. Slowly you begin to feel the occasional flash of heat, which prompts you to shiver again as it disappears and the shady, cold, damp remains. You trudge closer and closer. Your head swims with the drink. Then a hand clasps your shoulder and you stop. The circle is near, nearer than you thought. Flames lit around each stone, and in the centre stands a white bull, its horns wreathed with garlands of wildflowers. A thick leather cord is tied around its neck, the other end wrapped three times around a small stone. Beneath the bull, held in place by small mounds of rocks and nine beakers, the sides of the nearest stones are stained dark with blood. Another tripod with a large leather bag sits just outside the circle, filled with liquid the same dark, still colour as the last. There is no bread. In and out the stones weave women. Their long dark hair is tied with blue ribbons and their robes are clean and white. Their feet are clad in soft shoes that make their footsteps near silent. You feel a knife at the top of your back, where the hem of your tunic reaches your neck. Presses into your skin and then rips down, cutting you slightly and tearing through your tunic. The tunic falls away, leaving you naked. Your back is bare to the cool damp, while the flames flicker out towards your front. Again, you shiver. There's nothing on the air, save for the nervous breathing of your compatriots. Each one is naked and hugging themselves. And at their feet, their ruined clothes rustle, and in front of you all, the bull breathes his hot breath. The tenth man nods towards the burly men, and you are pushed and shuffled until you and the others surround the circle. Three women enter the ring. One holds a knife that shines and glints a vibrant yellow. The bull begins to paw the ground and toss its head. Standing slightly out of reach, the women bow their heads. They stand like that, in silence, until the bull calms down and its head stops its frenetic tossing. Two of the women walk towards the bull. They stroke its nose and firmly grasp its horns. The central woman steps forward in three steps. The beast tries to flick its head, but the other two women hold it steady. The third woman thrusts her blade deep into the bull's throat. She holds it there for half a second and then rips the knife away. The bull bellows. It's deafening and blood explodes from its throat, covering the woman and splattering you and your companions. The 9 beakers beneath the bull fill rapidly with bright red blood. To its knees, the bull falls, moaning and tossing, and the women back away. "Thus you see," announces the 10th man, as the bull's death throes subside. "Death should be calm. Death should be silent. And yet it is often quick, loud, and brutal. Do not fear death, young ones. It is only the beginning. And now, you drink. And as you drink, reflect on this beast's fear and your own nerves. Are you like the beast? Or can you face torment knowing that better things often await on the other side of destruction?" The women, their white clothes drenched in bright blood, fill beakers to the brim with the brown liquid and take it to each of the naked young folk. You take one. It is slick and sticky with the liquid, and its decoration feels rough beneath your fingertips. Even in your hand, you can smell the hairy, spicy scent. You're not given any bread. Instead, the 3 women and 10th man look at you all expectantly. You raise the beaker to your lips and nearly gag at the hairy, boozy smell wafting towards you. You force the drink down and it seems to sting your nostrils. Holding back your gag, you keep drinking, breathing through your nose, trying to keep the stench out of your mind. The drink seems to take an immediate detour to your brain. Your head feels thicker, slightly off balance, and your tummy tingles. And then you're doused by something warm and viscous. Your eyes turn red, and your mouth is filled with a hot, iron-like taste. You wipe your eyes and look down to see blood. You look at your compatriots, and their nakedness is now covered with the blood of the bull. Their hair is matted, their bodies bright and red like newborns. The 10th man speaks. "We continue. Follow me." He returns to the avenue. The path is beginning to move uphill. Looking upwards, you see sunlight, unencumbered and shining brightly. You wipe your face again and head off after the 10th man. You sense the burly man behind you still. Your tongue is thick, your head heavy, and your belly is hot. The liquid swirls inside you. The ground is rising and feels drier as you move further up the hillside. It's a gentle slope and easy to walk, especially as the sun gets free range to bear down upon you again. The blood begins to dry in your skin, crusting over your eyes, nostrils and lips, and turn your hair into an uncomfortable mess. Your belly is churning, and your head is swimming as the liquid bounces around inside of you. You wipe your eyes and keep moving forwards. The peak of the hill, unwooded, is to your left. It's an untouched hillside, covered in dark green grass above which flutters butterflies and small birds. Your hearing feels attuned to the frenetic panting of their wings, but you're halfway, you might just be making that up. The avenue is heading up towards a ridgeway slightly lower than the hilltop. This is the happiest you've been in ages. Your crusty, bloody skin feels pleasant as the breeze rolls over every inch of you. The ground is soft still, but dry and pleasantly cool. Even if the sounds are phantasmic, then at least they're pleasant. You smile, close your eyes, and keep treading onwards up the pleasant path into bright sunlight. You reach the peak of the low slope you've been climbing. The sun is bright here. You rub your eyes, blink away the white spots, and gaze upon a busy scene. The second avenue you had seen from the hill was in view again and full of people. The ancient gathering place had returned to view, and beneath you lay a vast circle. Its walls were bright white and colossal, taller than two men, with a deep ditch behind them. Behind the circle, bright white and grey smoke plumed from 100 distant campfires. Behind the circle, bright white and grey smoke plumed from 100 distant campfires. There was a hint of roasting meat in the air, and chatter swelled from the avenue. The world was full of life. "Look to your left," says the tenth man. As a group, you turn around. You see the bowl of the hills surrounding the vast circle. The gathering place is looking right at you, and the mound is watching over the second avenue. You cannot see the tombs. They are hidden by the hill, but you know they're there. You glance behind you, over the shoulder of the burly man who has remained near you, silent and threatening. The stone circle, that place of death and fear, is out of sight, and the timber circle where you began looks back towards you. Through your foggy mind, the hills around you feel like walls surrounding a place of death and a place of life. The tenth man continues. "This is what awaits us all. Community, welcome and acceptance, overseen by the ancestors and elders. There is much to come. Hold to this warmth and beauty. It sits at the end of all our trials and tribulations. We now enter the final stretch. You may find what comes next to be the most tormenting of times. Remember, you are loved and accept every gift you are given. These people want you only to thrive. Once more, follow me." The tenth man sets off along the ridgeway, along the avenue, towards the circle. You walk along the ridgeway top, past pairs of stones with butterflies, bees, and other insects flitting around them. Soon, you come to a bend in the avenue, and there you are stopped. Two large stones stand where you are halted, hiding your view of the white circle and of the mound. The only thing you can see with any certainty is the gathering place, atop the steep hill, looking down into the bowl of hills and ridges you are standing within. The group has bunched together. You glance at each other, nervous, uncertain, and drunk. This is the closest you've been since you were stripped naked at the stone circle. Unable to resist, your eyes flutter down your companion's naked, bloody bodies. A hand slams onto your shoulder. It's the burly man behind you. He yanks you away from the group. Your eyes dart around you as your feet scramble beneath you. The same thing is happening to your compatriots. You're being pulled apart, spread along the avenue, each of you flanked by two of the avenue's stones. And then the tenth man begins to talk to each of you in turn. To companion after companion, he speaks, too softly for you to hear, and then passes them a third beaker, larger than the previous two, and pats them on the shoulder. Eventually, the tenth man reaches you. "Before the end comes the wait. You must make the rest of this journey alone and in darkness. You will drink deep and then be blindfolded once more. Trust your guard. He will keep you true and do as you're told. The journey is nearly over. Good luck." With that, he clasps you on the shoulder and hands you a beaker so large it takes both of your hands to hold it. "Drink deep, young one," says the burly man behind you. "What comes next is better the more you have drunk." So you drink, and then drink some more, and then keep on drinking. The drink is like burnt honey. It's rich and sweet and acrid, and it never seems to end. You keep on drinking. Your lungs are burning, your mouth is alive, and eventually the flow begins to slow. It turns to a dribble and then a drop. You ease the cup away from your lips. Little liquid runs down your chin. And then a cloth is pulled over your eyes from behind. The world turns black and the mask is pulled tight. And then a coarse rope is slips over your head and tightens a little around your neck. You're in the same state as you were before the timber circle, in darkness and at risk of throttling. Except now you were naked, with a full stomach and a dizzy head. You can smell meat roasting in the distance, and beneath it, the sweet smell of fire smoke made from maple and crabapple wood. He barely grumbles, too much liquid and nothing but the scrap of bread so long ago. You shake your head. Bad idea. Even in the blackness beneath the blindfold, your eyes dart with white spots. You feel a little nauseous. Instead, you focus on your breathing, in through the nose, out through the mouth. You do your best to enjoy the warm sun and the cooling breeze. You try and find the sounds of butterflies and grassland birds. Filling your ears, though, is the pumping of your blood. The blood, which is cracked around your ears, becomes itchy and distracting. You keep your hands by your sides. Something tells you that this discomfort is deliberate, beneficial even. You fall into as calm a state as possible. You focus on the hard ground beneath your feet. There's a slight tingle at the tips of your fingers. There's a slight ache between your shoulder blades that you've not noticed before, and one of your back teeth is a little loose. That is all new. And you can't help but feel the fragility of your body. You try not to think of the desperate look in the cow's eyes as it was slaughtered. It isn't right to think that that might be you someday, dying and not knowing why, surrounded by people supposed to care for you. All at once, you feel very, very alone. A small tear escapes, despite you trying to blink it back. It rolls down your cheek.
"It's time," the burly man says.
He puts his hand on your shoulder and urges you to start moving. The noose tightens as you are pulled forward. You walk and walk and walk. You've no idea where you're going. The world is getting quieter. The pathway gets softer.
"Kneel," orders the burly man. "And don't move."
You fall to your knees. You feel the rope around your neck tied to something a little away from you. A presence brushes past you and thin, soft cloth brushes against your shoulder. It's deathly quiet, but you can hear people breathing around you. Someone seems to be crying, but softly, indistinctly. The sounds feel kind of close, like you're trapped with the sounds, unaware of where they are, like a moth is flapping near you while you try to fall asleep.
"You know not where you kneel."
A voice booms around you. It seems to come from all around. You think it's the tenth man, it sounds like him, but not in the way you've grown accustomed to. His voice booms and surrounds your ears, blasting through the blindfold.
"Generations of ancestors look down upon you always. You are watched, even when you do not know it. In this place, the great skies look down upon our ancestors, who look down upon our people, and who look down upon you now, as you kneel, naked and alone. Often, we forget our connection to these people. Our own joys and infirmities blind us to the truth that we are all one and will become one when we join the ancestors. To forget the ancestors, the community, is to invite devastation. You are isolated now, blood splattered, blind and deafened, unaware of the land you tread upon. Today you have walked upon land with no knowledge of why. You have feasted and drank without question. There has been no sacrifice, no work to justify such liberty. Such actions deserve destruction."
The blindfold is ripped from your eyes and the world explodes in noise. You bow your head, squeeze your eyes shut and cover your ears. Someone grabs your hair and pulls your hair back. You force your eyes open and the world is terrible. You are kneeling in a circle like that one in which you saw the cow. All around you are vast fires burning bright. Enormous crowds surround the ring. They are banging drums and yelling. Each one of your companions is tied to a stone, like the bull. Behind them, holding their hair and exposing the necks of burly men. Each one holds a knife and looks ready for slaughter. Some of your companions are sobbing, others are screaming with terror. You are dumb, silenced, overwhelmed and unsure as to what to do. The tenth man raises a vast club. At its end is an enormous stone, and at the tenth man's feet is another giant rock of grey limestone. You glance around. The burly men are raising knives, the blades pointing upwards towards the sky. You try and move away, but the rope pulls taut against the stone. A steady hand grasps your left shoulder, holding you tightly. Tears begin to stream down your face. The tenth man brings down his club, which cracks hard on the rock. The club shatters, as does the stone. It's like a whip crack or a falling tree. You see the other burly men drop their hands towards their wards, and your right hand shoulder explodes in pain. You scream, and you hear the screams of your companions. The burly men raise their now bloody knives again and bring them down. You feel one strike, and then another. And then the drumming fades. You're still alive. And then you feel something soft, wet, and a little dusty slap onto your shoulder. It's pain you've never known, all at once sharp and dull. You gasp, your throat is now hoarse and all out of screams. Tears are flowing freely. The hand on your left shoulder disappears, and then the cord around your neck is pulled away. You fall forwards, onto all fours. Your shoulder feels as though it's on fire. The tenth man steps into the middle. He smiles down at each of you. You have been marked, so all who see you know the wisdom revealed to you today. The three marks on your shoulder represent your lack of understanding at the start of our journey, the deathly journey we took, and the ordeal which you have just experienced. Know the mark on your shoulder ties you to this land. We must all tend to it so that it may support us in return. You have seen the fate that await those who betray the land. That is but a glimpse. Your family will be with you soon. Recover, young ones. Dress yourselves, then join the rest, those who now rely upon you. Richer food and cooler drink than you've had today await when you are ready. He pauses, looks down at each of you, and smiles again. Well done. The past, so they say, is a foreign country. They do things differently there. If that's a truism, then it's a good one. I should probably be more cautious with my interpretations of the past than I have been with this episode. Yes, these people lived in the same part of the world we do. Yes, they may have looked like us. Heck, there's a chance that I, via my Welsh mother, am even related to some of them. Even so, these are not the same people as us. This becomes more and more true the further in time we go back. It's not just that there's less evidence. These people don't live in the same context as us. They don't know what is going to happen to them or after them. And it is what happens in history that contextualizes the world in which we live. That means many of the assumptions that we make about human nature, human relationships, society, and the natural world are all just that. Assumptions. It's a constant fight to identify and remove those assumptions. For example, we have absolutely zero idea as to what Silbury Hill was used for. None at all. I read as many articles as I could and created an interpretation that seemed best suited to my imagination. When there is so little evidence, that's sometimes the best we can manage. The same goes for Windmill Hill, the Causewayed Enclosure or Gathering Place. Causewayed enclosures and cursuses are two types of large early Neolithic monuments for which we have no real conclusions or consensus about their use. All of which to say again is that the story you just heard is at most a best guess solution. Whole sections were deleted when I realised that this was just an analogy for Christianity. In trying to create something that resonates with my listeners in the 21st century, I've made assumptions or simplifications that move this from a work of academic imagination into the world of historical fiction. That's okay. That is what it is meant to be, a piece of fiction which, at the very least, I hope, gives a somewhat accurate flavour of life in the late Neolithic. I've tried to avoid assumptions around gender, of knowledge, of hierarchy, and I know I have, to an unknown extent, failed. And yet, that too is okay. The aim of today's show was to entertain. Also, I hope, give you an experience of how a complex, multi-phase landscape was used by and experienced by the people who built said landscape. This is something new. A whole show is a single story. No discussion of evidence, the bare minimum of theoretical explanation and post-narrative apologies. I'd love to know what you think. Did you like this? Was it frustrating? Is this a delicious but occasional treat or something which you would enjoy more of? Let me know. My email is oldbonespodcast@gmail.com. The website is oldbones.co.uk and you can find me on both Facebook and Instagram by searching Old Bones. All of those links are in the episode description. If you really, really love this episode and want to have more influence on the direction of the show, then be like Eli and join me on Patreon. I want this show to be a communal effort, so I do listen and do ask for suggestions. However, rather than ending on the social shoutouts, let me tell you what is coming up. There are three more episodes to come before season two begins. Next month, we will talk to Dr. Ed Caswell. He works for the Portable Antiquities Scheme like Heather, but unlike Heather, he is a prehistorian specializing in the Bronze Age. At the end of that episode, there will be a very important announcement, so you'll want to tune in. After that, we must say a very fond farewell to prehistory for a while. We'll talk to Professor David Petz, an expert on the early medieval period and the man who dug Binchester and is digging at Lindisfarne. This will act as a companion episode to the last of these specials, which is the introduction to Series 2. That should be a lovely episode. We'll introduce the areas we're going to cover, the themes we'll discuss, and the things which, unfortunately, we'll have to miss out. In the meantime, if you want to brush up on all things Anglo-Saxon, you will definitely want to start listening to the British History Podcast. Jamie at the BHP takes a very detailed document-led approach and is aiming to cover every period of British history. In the middle of June 2020, he's 350 episodes in and he's just reached 1020 CE. So you can imagine the loving, fascinating detail he goes into. And now, thank you all for listening today. I'll see you next month. I'm Andy Earnshaw, and this is Old Bones.